There are extra sheets up in front if you don't have a handout, and we will follow the order that's on the sheet. I was thinking of trying to rearrange it like chronologically, but I thought it'd be more confusing. So if you don't have a sheet, we're going to follow the list that would be right on here alphabetically. So I'm just going to read what we have here. So elder panel will consist of two parts. The first hour will consist of 4 to 5 minute mini talks on the present and future state of Israel. The second hour will be questions primarily from the audience. That would be your part in the program. And it will be supplemented by panel members and the chairman. So look the list over and prepare your questions for the panel members. And we cannot overstate the importance of Israel in God's program for salvation. I'd like to mention two more things, that there is a website called Arutz, Arutz, if that's the right name to pronounce it. And if you have a computer, it comes on 2 or 3 times a week all about Israel. And if you're interested, you could contact Brother Mark Kendall, Alice Schneider, or myself, and we would give you the website, and it's free. And it's all about what's going on in Israel. And the next point I'd like to mention is 1967, I was deeply impressed with the fact that Israel captured or they controlled Jerusalem. We're aware of the scriptures that say that the word of the Lord has to come from Jerusalem. So this, in my mind, is a very marked, important fulfillment of prophecy. So at the present time, we have a wide selection of all the brethren here, and we're going to talk about the present and the future conditions, or what's going on in Israel at the present time. So we're going to start our discussion now with Brother Richard Doctor.
Good morning, brethren. We'd like to talk about the subject of Persia in the news, but of course the present-day name for that country is Iran. And Russ, the next slide, please. Why we need to focus on them comes to us from Ezekiel 38, which Brother Peter's going to talk about. But they are listed as one of the principal enemies of the Lord's people. And we find them in this cooperative arrangement. We will go into who these are shortly. Next, please. While we've looked at Hamas in the news, the Palestinian uprising, it's important to remember that they have been supplied with the weapons that they've been firing by Israel by Iran. They are surrogate in this, and of course, it's important to realize that the Iranians are not on the sidelines at all, but they are very involved with being active enemies of Israel right now in delivering weapons, as well as the rhetoric that's come from them. Next, Brother Russ. Also, this week in the news, brethren, this is a watershed week for the Palestinians. We didn't know that at the time selecting this topic, but the UN vote that Brother Chris alluded to in his first talk is one that is very important, because the Palestinians have kept trying to bring before the Court of World Opinion the excesses and things done wrong by the Israeli army, and no doubt there are excesses and things done wrong. This doesn't mean we don't support Israel, but things happen in war that are not Christian. And so they've been upgraded from to a status where they're a non-member observer, which gives them legal standing before the Hague Court. They've been trying to have this for years. They got it Friday. So we're going to be seeing some new developments there. And on Saturday, they already said, you know, we'd like to bring some issues up to the court. Okay, next slide, please. Here we have Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is a crackpot, but But he, in some senses, he's a Hitler-style crackpot. He has all of the attitudes and biases and hates that a Hitler has, and he has all of the technical support of world-class quality that Hitler had during World War II. The Iranians have always been amongst the leading scientists in the world. Currently, there's two colleges that still offer nuclear courses in the United States, Texas and MIT. The MIT lead is an expat from Iran. 1,000 years ago, the Iranian scientist measured the solar year to 1/2000th of a second, which is as close as you need to do it, using an astrolabe, sundial, and water clock. At the same time, another Iranian scientist figured out that the Earth's atmosphere was about 52 miles high, correctly, using dusk to calculate that. These scientists in Iran who are shown here next to the centrifuges that are currently being used for enrichment are absolutely world-class and very capable individuals. Next slide, please. Right now, at the first facility, which is German-designed, an old missile silo, 240 feet underground, there are 696 operational centrifuges to produce U-235, which is the fissile material that you need to separate from U-238 to make a weapon. You need about 250 kilograms approximately, probably less if you really know what you're doing. There are now an additional site that is going to bring online nearly 2,800 centrifuges. It turns out that the first site, in fact, is not capable of getting knocked out by U.S. weapons that could be carried by a stealth bomber, since the Iranians have calculated correctly that the U.S. will not use a nuclear weapon to take out that facility, and our conventional weapons can't hit it. Again, reported on Friday, November 16th, they have finished the next critical stage in preparing these weapons. Next, please. Next, please, Russ. Okay. Over a year ago, Ehud Barak said, you've got to stop it early this year or else it's not going to be controlled. It didn't happen. And he's correct. Next, please. So the last thing I want to close with, these are the good old days, brethren, because it turns out that there is now an advanced system for refining uranium. This is an editorial that appeared in the one of the world's leading journals that's interdisciplinary science, Nature, from October of this year, saying, there is now a license in place for a lower cost, easier to hide, more easy to use weapon separation system that's laser based, which means that people can start producing nuclear materials undetected. Next, please. Why does a tactical nuclear weapon need to be taken seriously? Joel 2:30, I'll show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. But if you look in the margin, those are palm-like columns of smoke. We need to take this seriously, brethren.
Thank you very much, Brother Richard. We're off to a wonderful start. Next will be Brother Peter Karavis, and he has chosen Ezekiel 38.
Okay, we may discuss some aspects that aren't covered as much about Ezekiel 38. But just a disclaimer, my comments will include some speculation, so listen with caution. The question is, how do we get from Psalms 83 to Ezekiel 38? Because in Psalms 83, which will be covered, the enemies are Arab enemies, and they want to totally destroy Israel. But in Ezekiel 38, Sheba and Dedan are the Arab nations, and they're not enemies. As a matter of fact, they're asking the enemy, what are you doing? Are you coming to take a spoil? So how do we get from point A to point B? And a suggestion I'll offer is that once this war is ended with the Arabs, an era of peace begins, and Israel realizes that this land for peace deals don't work. They'll always try to, their enemies will always try to destroy them. So this final battle has to be complete. They have to completely take out the people trying to destroy them, install safer governments, and then form economic ties so that each of these Arab nations are benefiting economically from Israel. And so there's a partnership. Now, as we go into Ezekiel 38, Israel enters that with a condition of pride and rebellion. They're not putting their faith in the Lord. And we're told this in Zephaniah 3, verses 11 to 12. Now, in Ezekiel 38, we're going to read verses 10 to 12. Thus says the Lord, it will come about on that day that thoughts will come into your mind. This is the enemy of Israel, the land from the north and their allies. You will devise an evil plan, and you will say, I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will go against those who are at rest, who live securely, all of them without walls and having no bars and gates. So Israel is described as a land dwelling securely without bars and gates. Why are they coming against Israel? To capture spoil, to seize plunder, to turn your hand against the waste places which are now inhabited, and against the people who have been gathered from the nations, who have acquired cattle and goods, and who live in the center of the earth. Now, first, this point about unwalled villages and without walls, we find a passage in Jeremiah 49, verses 30 to 32, that talks about Babylon's destruction of Arab peoples who are without walls or bars or gates. These are people living in villages and tents. They don't have walls. So we think that this concept is referring to military defenses. So that's the opposite of the condition of Israel today. In the recent battle, fighting with the Gaza Strip missiles, Israel used their Iron Dome anti-missile defense system, which has an 85 to 95% accuracy. And Israel's already successfully testing the next generation of defense called the Magic Wand. This is comes after this Iron Dome interceptor, and it's also known as David's Sling. And this will operate as a totally national defense system, and it will be an upgrade from what they have now, which is already up to 90% accurate. Okay, so Israel's not going to have this in this Ezekiel 38 battle. What's going to cause them to drop their defensive posture and to not be building up their military? Well, it's because they're going to be at peace at this time. It says that they're at rest and live security, a peaceful people who dwell in safety. That's what we read in Ezekiel 38. And it says they live in the center of the world. Okay, Israel's in the center of the world geographically and economically. Israel joins three continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa, and it has ports to the Mediterranean Sea and through the Gulf of Aqaba to the Red Sea. So they're the ideal place to be the center of world commerce. And they will be the center of world commerce at this time. The Arab nations will be at peace with them. The situation will be totally turned around. The Arab nations will be economic partners. So all the children of Abraham will be economically benefiting at a time where in the West, in the rest of the world, they'll probably be coming out of a worldwide depression, which we may now be entering, which may be the Plague 6, the Plague of Darkness. Now, we're probably running out of time, but there's evidence that from Joel and other places that this battle takes place in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, we think that's symbolic, but there may be a secondary literal meaning to it. The Valley of Jehoshaphat is just east of the Dead Sea, and the Dead Sea is full of trillions of dollars of mineral wealth. So in this final battle, Israel will expand its borders. They'll own both sides of the Dead Sea. They'll have a waterway going from the Mediterranean Sea down to, diving all the way down to the Dead Sea with a hydroelectric power plant so that they could cheaply refine all these minerals at a very low cost. They'll be the wealth envy of all the nations. And this, and plus technologically in other ways as well. And this will be the temptation that the nations will be jealous and they'll come down and want to seize this wealth and this power. I'm probably out of time, aren't I?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Brother Peter. Appreciate it very much. It's hard to be in for a time constraint, but we'd like to have the audience participate too. We thank you for your comments. That was very informative. Now we have Brother Chris Nopchinski is going to talk about understanding the denial of the Holocaust.
Okay. Well, I thought that we can just spend a few minutes discussing this because it's quite interesting that in the day when we feel that there is no questions and no doubts about the Holocaust, especially against the Jewish people, having happened in the Second World War, that there would be any doubts or any deniers or denials that this ever happened, or as we will discuss, to what extent there's that denial. But just to define terms, the Holocaust and the terminology that we would use here is that the Germans in the Second World War had a organized plan to eliminate down to a single existing Jewish person. That they basically had the goal of eliminating the entire nation of Israel. This was Hitler's plan. And as we just recently learned, he was going to have a museum. I think he was looking to have a museum of the nation of Israel in Prague, in which everything that would be in that museum would be in past tense. This used to be a nation that no longer is. Well, the effect that his efforts had were dramatic, and we have heard the number of 6 million Jews having perished in the Holocaust. But you will ask yourself the question, well, how do we know that? And as it turns out, the answer is very difficult. The accounting of these numbers is coming from many different directions. There was no record in the German army that actually had all these people that were being eliminated and exterminated listed in any sort of publicly published document. Even though Germans were very good about those records, yet it was a practice in the 1941 when they came up with the so-called the final solution to eliminate the Jews. It was their practice to keep it very secretive. And if you go to any of the sites of the concentration camps, you will see a lot of efforts that were done whenever they were exiting those locations to really hide and completely eradicate any traces so that the evidence couldn't be found. And so this really serves a very good purpose now to those who would have any sort of agenda and reason to deny that this special effort to exterminate the Jewish nation was being carried out. And as a result, the three directions in which they will try to undermine the Holocaust had the effect that we state it had is the three R's: relativizing, revising, and reversing. Relativizing would be an argument that basically would say, well, this wasn't really the only outburst of violence against a nation. There were other nations that also suffered, and basically the focus from really asserting the fact that the Jews were the ones that were the target for this effort to completely be eradicated is minimized. revising is dealing with reducing the impact of it, basically questioning any of the evidence that exists, saying, well, it's not possible really that 6 million of these beings have perished. And there is, in fact, some supposed to be educated and informed people, even in the church environments, that say, well, the number of the Jews probably was about 200,000 to 300,000 that have perished. And there is really no evidence that there were that they were destroyed in gas chambers. Reversing is another tactic that we may see, and it's quite popular these days, where the roles of the oppressor and the oppressed would be reversed. Of course, you've heard from many different news articles that the terminology of territory being occupied or Israel being the oppressor is used, and you will see sometimes depictions of Israelis really taking the roles of the Nazis and the people that live in the Palestinian camps would be the ones that now are the persecuted ones. So this would be the reversal. And why is this happening? Because the nations don't want to feel very badly about the special nature of the nation of Israel. If there could only be some way to excuse condemnation for Israel, they would probably do it with, it would be a little easier because it really hurts cultural and educational pride to say that civilized nation had allowed for this to occur back in the Second World War. So anything that would undermine it, minimize it, delegitimize it would be something that would be supportive of that tendency. So we, as we conclude this, because we don't have much more time and there's a lot more to learn online and in other resources, you can certainly look at the Yad Vashem website to read about that. There's a good lecture from Ephraim Kay, as well as Rabbi Beryl Wine, you will find him on YouTube, has a very good lecture about the various problems that have a connection with denying the Holocaust, including inside of Jewish society, now that there's a few generations that have passed from that time.
Thank you very much, Brother Chris. That was a very good definition. Now we're going to turn to Brother Aaron Keymichael, and he has chosen technology. Brother Aaron.
Turn it on. Yeah, when you think about technology, I mean, it touches all of our lives. And I hadn't really realized just how influential or how Israel's technology permeates the cultures that we live in and the different things that they do. So what I have here is a report from CleanTech, the global 100 companies in the world, that this organization goes through and they rate and they rank the companies. And it says, if you follow along in some of the text, North America represents 69% of the top 100 countries. And then skipping down a little bit, it says that viewing the number of winning companies in relation to gross domestic product reveals a different story, with Israel leading for density of high-impact clean tech companies within an economy. They also rank highly in second place on the index, which measures a country's potential to produce innovative private clean tech companies. And if you look at this, the graphic, they had four companies in 2011. They had six companies that qualified in 2012. They had a net increase of two. But here's the point the article's making. 25.5 companies per $1 trillion of GDP versus the United States, which has 4.2 companies per $1 trillion of gross. So you have a very tiny country that has a tremendous amount of their economy is based on technology. And in this particular slice of that technology, we're just looking at companies that have qualified for clean, such as some of the solar companies that they have, some of the hydro companies that they have, desalination companies, etc. Let me flip over to another slide here. And there's several reasons why, before I go on, flip the slide, there are several reasons why Israel is such a leader in technology. And the three basic ones are, is first of all, they rely heavily on the immigration, the intellectual capacity of the immigrants that come into their nation. You know, we talk about this Palestinian issue where after the war, Six-Day War, they had these Palestinians isolated. A lot of nations don't realize, a lot of people don't realize that 800,000 Jews came back to Israel during that period of time frame from the Arab nations, and they lost everything. And then since then, you've had millions, literally millions of individuals come in, many of them from Russia, with very high intellectual educations and intellectual training. They didn't have the technology behind it, but when they got to Israel, they were able to implement their knowledge into a technological environment. So the first one was the immigration. The second reason they have that they're very good at what they do for technology is that the government stands behind them and they seed companies. So they invest into the entrepreneurship of their nation. So instead of funding, you know, other projects, they stick a lot of money into developing companies. And the third main reason is that they have a conscription. You have to serve in the military in Israel. And so what they do is they pull all these individuals in and they tap them for their technological skills. And because Israel has to always come up with fast ways to solve big problems, they develop this entrepreneur mentality within the young of the nation itself. And so what they do is then when they get out of the military, one of the first things they do, many of them, is they start their own companies. Because they've got the technological training and experience developing and leading big projects under high speeds using, you know, good technology. And secondly, the government steps up behind them and says, we're going to help you do it. So those are the three main reasons why. But when you look at some of the products, you know, the computer chips that we use, a lot of them have been developed, the cell phones, Motorola's from, you know, Israel. Peter mentioned this Iron Dome. It's the first system in the world that can shoot down a rocket. And depending upon which statistics you look at, the government says they had about a 33% success ratio, which means that for every three rockets that were fired, they shot down one of them. However, that's not a completely accurate statistic because they actually say their accuracy is 85%. Because they don't shoot down every rocket that's fired at them. And what they do is with their this iron defense system, they calculate the trajectory of where this rocket's going to land. If it's going to land in a harmless area, they let the rocket go. And then they don't shoot it down. So they have an 85% accuracy. If they target a rocket to destroy, 85 times of 100 they're going to. And one of the websites showed that they estimate there's 20,000 rockets pointing at them from their neighboring countries, over 20,000 rockets, which is why they are trying to accelerate their national defense systems. Many of the technologies that we see in our everyday life, you know, they have pill cameras that you can swallow. That's Israeli development. A lot of the web applications, there's Israeli development. So when a company or a country or an individual says, I want to boycott Israel and their technology, you can't because they're so pervasive. And we can see the Lord's hand in the way that technology has been being implemented and the way it's been developed.
Thank you very much, Brother Aaron. Our next would be Brother Dan Larson, and he has chosen Jacob's Trouble.
Jacob's Trouble. Jacob's trouble is a phrase that comes from Jeremiah, the 30th chapter and verse 7, which reads in the King James, Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. We recognize also the whole 30th chapter is one of the places in Scripture that talks about Jacob's trouble and also deals with the time period of the overlapping of the gospel in the millennial ages. The end of Jacob's trouble marks the beginning of the mediatorial phase of the kingdom, and the overlapping will be complete. It is about this time that all of Israel's lovers shall leave her, and she stands alone on the world scene. Based on Jeremiah, the 30th chapter, 14th verse. And then Gog and Magog decide to invade Israel to gain a spoil, Ezekiel 38:11-12, which Brother Peter talked about. And today, I'm not going to develop any new insights into what the spoil might be, as there are numerous possibilities as to what has been presented by the brethren over the years. Perhaps it is fresh water. Perhaps it is a cheap way of achieving all the minerals in the Dead Sea, or possibly a cheap method of desalinization, or perhaps it is oil. Or possibly, maybe it's the holy city of Jerusalem itself, so sacred to all three of the world's chief religions. In Zechariah, the 14th chapter, verses 1 and 3, we see that Israel, including in her those who were trusting in the national strength, are being overthrown and are just about to be vanquished by the invasion of Gog and Magog. You know, incidentally, this would be the first defeat of Israel's military since they have been regathered. Next to the United States, Israel has the most top-ranked military in the world. There has been much speculation as to whom Gog and Magog may represent. Suggestions have included the Eastern Russian peoples and the Muslims of Eastern Europe, Russia, Iran, Iraq, etc. Right now, I'm inclined towards thinking that it may be the Muslims, since the Russian bear has been come to naught as a unified power. But all of southern Russia, are all the Muslim areas and unified, you know, in their own right as Muslims. And you have to remember that Muslims claim Jerusalem as its own. At the height of this dreadful onslaught of Israel, the ancient worthies will be resurrected. In fellowship in the years past, the following idea was offered to me, and it appeals to me very much, although Scripture does not so state. Perhaps the invasion of Gog and Magog will take place during the spring of the year around Passover. The non-religious Jews will go out to fight the battle, leaving the faithful at home celebrating the traditional Passover Seder. And as you will remember, at the Seder, an extra place is made for one more than the expected number of people, and an extra cup is poured. And this is called Elijah's cup. And as the celebrants pray and lift up their cups, perhaps the various ancient worthies will enter the homes of and come in and participate with the Passover meal, explaining who they are, and are able to convince the then-ready hearts of those Jews that God's kingdom is being set up and that the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth, is the force behind the events taking place around them. The ancient ones will remind them that as God's chosen people, they will have the opportunity to receive the kingdom blessings, and that God has heard their prayers and for their deliverance of the horrors of Ezekiel 14. And in Micah, the 4th chapter, they will able to convince them to leave all their hope in God's hands, for they cannot save themselves from the slaughter. And when they do, and they recognize that Jesus and the church as their Messiah, who are the angels of God, to fight for them as God fought for them in the days of old, Ezekiel 39:1, verses 1, 6, and 7, and the battle will be won.
Brother Roy.
Thank you, Brother Dan. I enjoyed the points about the spoil. We're going to talk about that later on. Next will be Brother Russ Martin, and he has chosen natural resources and invention. Brother Russ.
That's okay. Thank you, Brother Irwin. Yeah, we're going to kind of tie this all into really some of the remarks that have already been made by Brother Aaron and actually Brother Dan. You know, we're all familiar with the prophecy in Daniel that knowledge will be increased at this time. And we take that to mean that knowledge will be increased not only in the West and in Europe, and in Asia, but also in the Middle East and in Israel as well. What we'd like to do is give you some examples to show you how that has come about in the inventions that have come out of Israel and even in their development of their natural resources, and then tie it into, again, the final situation that Israel will face, as mentioned by Brother Dan. You know, Brother Aaron mentioned that one of the inventions in the area of medicine was the pill camera, a camera that you literally can swallow and that it transmits a picture back so doctors can look at your insides without cutting you open as in surgery. They've also invented the world's smallest video camera, less than a millimeter in diameter. Remember, a centimeter is about the width of your finger. A millimeter is one-tenth of that, and the size of this camera is actually smaller than 1 millimeter. One of probably Israel's most famous inventions, although you wouldn't probably know it on the street, is this device right here, a USB flash drive, thumb drive, key drive, whatever you want to call it. These devices hold roughly anywhere from a gigabyte to 128 gigabytes is about the current technology right now. Now, to impress that upon you, when you wanted to take data and transfer between computers before, you would use a floppy disk drive. That held 1 megabyte. So this particular drive holds 8 gigabytes. It holds the equivalent of almost 6,000 floppies. Covered this table, 6,000 floppies. So, and that came out of Israel, although some companies in Asia dispute that and they want to claim it. But it's certainly an invention that Israel has put forth. You know, Brother Aaron also mentioned Motorola and their involvement in the development of the cell phone using the plant in Israel. Motorola's plant in Israel is located in Tel Aviv. And while I worked there, I had the pleasure of working with some of the engineers and scientists that work at that plant, although not in the development of the cell phone, but in another high technology area, that being security and encryption. Israel is noted throughout the academic world and throughout the scientific world and the espionage world as overwhelmingly has an overwhelming amount of knowledge in this area. And I experienced that as well. One of the most common algorithms for compressing data into smaller amounts that is used to transmit it over the internet is called the LZW algorithm, or Limpel Ziv Welch. Two of those scientists reside in Israel. One is an American that collaborated with him on that. Let's move into a couple other areas. Energy, big area of technology, and batteries especially. Israel has developed a new class of rechargeable electric batteries based on a special kind of iron. It's more friendly than others because, you know, lithium batteries, lithium is a material that we don't know how to handle well in getting rid of it. But if you develop a battery out of the super ion, it eventually rusts. And we know that rust is not really dangerous to leave around and to get rid of. Israel has developed ways of generating electricity and also of producing hydrogen so that vehicles may use it as an alternative fuel source. And hydrogen is probably the power of the kingdom. You burn it, what do you get back? Energy and water. More than 3,800 startups have been established in Israel. Startup companies, technology companies have been established in Israel, making it second only to the U.S. in this sector. We could go on and on. The inventions of Israel are significant. The development of their natural resources also involves coming up with and developing more inventions. You know, rain only falls in Israel, normally in the wintertime, 6 months out of the year, and largely in the northern part of the country. One of the key enemy groups, though, of Israel is the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, in the southern end of the country, which gets very little water. That makes it absolutely imperative that Israel find water sources and transfer water efficiently throughout the country. And they have done this. They move water from the north end of the country, where the water is refurbished by the aquifers and the runoff from the mountains. How am I doing on time, Erwin?
One more minute.
Okay, I didn't want to run over. Anyway, that's one of their developments. Also, oil and natural gas. Recently, Israel last year and this year have discovered huge amounts of oil and natural gas in the Mediterranean, and also on their land as well. So the oil that's found on their land is the shale oil that you hear so much about being developed in this country, in North Dakota and up in Canada. And Israel is right now probably in possession of enough oil and natural resources to power the United States entirely for 35 years by itself. So there's a lot of oil there that they'll need it in the future. We're gonna, and let me give you just a few more interesting facts about some of the about Israel in regards to this. It's the 100th smallest country with less than 1/1000th of the world's population. But even though it has these limitations, it produces more scientific papers per capita than any other nation. Israel's ranked number 2 in the world for venture capital funds, right behind the United States. Outside of the U.S. and Canada, Israel has the largest number of NASDAQ, high technology companies. Israel's $100 billion economy is larger than all of its immediate neighbors combined. 24% of Israel's workforce holds university degrees, ranking it third in the industrial world. In 1984 and 1991, just to show you what they can do with their technology, Israel airlifted a total of 22,000 Ethiopian Jews at risk in Ethiopia safely to Europe. And the list goes on and on. We want to tie this together, though, with the increase of knowledge and Israel's destiny in the plans of God. They are going to need this technology to maintain themselves as a viable nation until the time that God fights for them personally and it becomes clear. So we see that the impartation of the increase of knowledge to Israel is key in that aspect. It will maintain them in a position, a viable position, as their allies and as their lovers desert them and leave them alone, to stand alone. And at that time, when technology is not sufficient for Israel's preservation, God will fight for them personally and as a witness to the world as in the establishment of the kingdom.
Thank you, Brother Russ. We're going to have quite a few questions for you during the question session. Next will be Brother Ted Martin, and he has chosen Ezekiel 37, which would be the Valley of Dry Bones. Brother Ted.
In Ezekiel 36-38, God has instructed the prophet to record prophecies in regard to the reinstatement of the nation of Israel back into his favor. In chapter 36, verse 22 and 23, God gives his reason for returning favor to his chosen people. He says there, "Therefore say unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord God, I do not this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for mine own holy name's sake, which ye have profaned among the heathen, whither ye went. And I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the heathen, which ye have profaned in the midst of them. And the heathen shall know that I am the Lord, saith the Lord God, when I shall be sanctified in you before their eyes." God is showing the nation of Israel that all of his favor to them is not a result of their deserving it, but it is because he chose them originally, and it is to glorify his holy name as being able to accomplish what he set forth in his word. In chapter 37, he records in symbolic terms the process of his returning favor in a familiar prophecy we call the Valley of Dry Bones. Ezekiel did not literally see this valley or the dry bones, but was shown a vision in which the things he reported took place. In view of this, we need to interpret the symbols in order to understand the message being conveyed to us. In verses 1 to 5, we read, "The hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley which was full of bones and caused me to pass by them round about. And behold, there were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Again he said to me, Prophesy upon these bones, and say unto them, O ye dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord God unto these bones, Behold, I will cause breath to enter into you, and you shall live." Note that in verse 11, we didn't read that, but down further in your text, it defines who the dry bones really are. He says it represents the whole house of Israel, their hopes, aims, and aspirations. There's no separation between the two-tribe kingdom and the ten-tribe kingdom that some would like to make. Ezekiel was asked there by God if the dry bones could live again, and he promptly turns the question back to God, knowing that he, Ezekiel, does not have the answer and that only God can truly answer the question. God assures him that indeed he will cause them to breathe and to live again. The dry bones refer not to the human lives of the individual Jews, but to the hopes and aspirations of Israel as a nation, to once again come into God's favor. After 1845 years of disfavor, the nation was destitute of any real hope of ever returning to God's favor. God reveals that he will bring them back to life to the point where they will once again be ready to exercise faith in the promises of God. Verse 6, "And I will lay sinews upon you and will bring up flesh upon you and cover you with skin and put breath in you, and ye shall live, and ye shall know that I am the Lord." The fact that the Lord in verse 6 refers to sinews, flesh, and skin seems to indicate that there will be a series of events that will mark different aspects of God's returning favor, which will occur over an unspecified period of time. In verse 7, there occurs two items to note. He says, "So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I prophesied, there was a noise, and behold, a shaking, and the bones came together, bone to his bone." The noise, we believe, was the sounding of the seventh trumpet, signifying the Lord's return and his beginning to take control of earth's affairs. The shaking would correspond well to the Berlin Congress of Nations that took place in 1878, the result of which was, among other things, there was a change in the status of the Jews who wanted to return to Israel. A shaking up or a change in the way other nations looked upon the Jews. Verse 8 continues to show the process of the bones receiving life. "And when I beheld, lo, the sinews and the flesh came upon them, and the skin covered them above, but there was no breath in them." The sinews and the flesh, we believe, represent the Zionist movement, which was instrumental in keeping the plight of the Jews before the world. The skin would represent the Balfour Declaration, which committed one of the most powerful and influential governments, Great Britain, to recognize the rights of the Jews to a homeland in Palestine. Verse 9 associates the four winds, usually a symbol of war, with the establishment of them as a nation, and that they might live. And so it was at the rebirth of that nation in 1948. Verses 10 to 14 give us details of the nation growing in stature among the nations of earth, with a gradual acknowledgement of God's providences. And yet they as a people still lack the Spirit of God, which he will bestow upon them when they finally acknowledge him fully as their God and recognize the one whom they has pierced as their Redeemer and life giver. We skimmed over very lightly this prophecy because of the restraint of time, but I think a consideration of it in detail is worth everyone's while, because the symbols are very powerful when we consider the Lord's purpose in reestablishing the nation of Israel.
Thank you very much, Brother Ted. Brother Joseph B. Guess has chosen Jacob's Trouble, Jeremiah 30, verses 1 to 8.
In Jeremiah 30, verses 1 to 9, we find the expression familiar to Bible students, Jacob's Trouble. I'll read Jeremiah chapter 30, verses 3, 5, 6, and 7. For lo, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will bring again the captivity of my people Israel and Judah, saith the Lord, and I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it. For thus saith the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask ye now and see whether a man doth travail with child. Wherefore do I see every man with his hands on his loins as a woman in travail, and all faces are turned into paleness. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. Picture in your minds the prophetic image Jeremiah presents to us here. Men, every man of Israel, with white faces, clutching their lower abdomen, doubled over in pain, likened to the pain that a woman experiences in childbirth. Some of the mothers here are probably thinking, boy, if only a man could feel what it's like to deliver a baby. On the pain scale of 1 to 10, childbirth is a 13. Brother Russell's early thought, in a Rupert article written in the year 1895, was that Jacob's trouble was already occurring, as exemplified by the popular support in Vienna, Austria, for an anti-Semitic political party called the Jew-haters, who advocated various persecutions of the Jews living in Vienna. In the last paragraph of that Views from the Tower article, on reprint page 1898, Brother Russell says, yes, we are in the time of Jacob's trouble. However, Brother Russell's later thought, expressed in volume 4, gives a more correct application of this prophecy to Israel when they are regathered in their land, as Jeremiah 30, verse 3, which we read earlier, declares. Listen to this from volume 4, page 552, under a subhead entitled The Time of Jacob's Trouble. Quote, while the trouble and distress of this day of the Lord will be first and specially upon Christendom and eventually upon all nations, the final blast, we are informed by the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 38, will be upon the people of Israel regathered in Palestine. The prophet seems to indicate a much larger gathering of Israel to Palestine within this harvest period than has yet taken place. He represents them as gathered there out of the nations in great numbers and with considerable wealth, inhabiting the formerly desolate places. End of quote. But notice here that Brother Russell identifies the final blast of Jacob's trouble with Ezekiel's prophecy in chapter 38, about which we heard earlier. My own thought, much like the pastor's later thought, is that Jacob's trouble takes place upon Israel, regathered in the land of Palestine. And as Jeremiah 30, verse 6 declares, Jacob's trouble is like a mother's birth pains, a repeating cycle of spasms that increase in both frequency and intensity. The pains grow stronger and come more quickly. Now, Israel became a nation in the land of Palestine in the year 1948. And a war with their Arab neighbors followed immediately that same year. And again, two brief wars took place in 1967 and 73. More recently, terrorist attacks launched by Arabs in the occupied territories of Gaza and the West Bank, aided by their supporters in Syria and Iran, have added to the level of conflict in the Middle East. I think perhaps in the future we will come to look back upon these events as the very early, early fulfillments of Jeremiah's proclamation of Jacob's trouble, the very early and beginning spasms of pain like a woman in travail. But I expect a far more intense trouble in the future. Today, Israel rests fairly easily, despite the rocket launches and occasional bus bombings, confident in their military weapons like the Iron Dome missile defense system and their precisely targeted airstrikes, along with the political support of the United States of America. Not until the attacks, both military and political, grow more frequent and stronger, so that Israel as a nation feels the pain of its enemies' attacks and doubles over like a mother in labor, will Jacob's trouble reach its climax. And then the prophecy will produce its desired result. Israel will no longer be confident in their own might. The blindness of Israel will be removed, and it will look to God for deliverance. Then the words of Jeremiah 30, verse 7, will be fulfilled. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. The resurrected ancient worthies will be God's instruments of deliverance, like the judges of Old Testament times, as prophesied in Isaiah 1:26. I will restore thy judges as at the first. And in Micah 5:5, then shall we raise eight princes of men. Thus shall Israel be saved out of Jacob's trouble by Jehovah's mighty hand, and the peace of Jerusalem will follow.
Very good. Thank you, Brother Joel. Next will be Brother Tom Ricciarello, and he has chosen modern-day miracles. Brother Tom.
Well, Brother, when we talk about these prophecies and everything the Lord has planned for Israel, we see that the reality happens on the ground, the boots on the ground, they might say. And as we look at some of the events that have happened in Israel, there are miracles after miracles that God has provided. When we talk about the rebirth of Israel, we recognize that its very existence is a modern-day miracle. But those big miracles are made up of little ones that are all put together to come up to an end result. You remember, those of you who were there, in May of 1948, the day after Israel declared its nationhood, 12 Arab nations attacked Israel. Israel had one cannon and five tanks, and they won. And the world looks at that and they say, how in the world did that ever happen? And I'd like to read a quote from a documentary video that Sister Sue Doctor has at the book. Well, she doesn't have it. I have it right now, but she will have it after I finish here. This is a quote from that film. It says, every time Israel is attacked, Pentagon and Kremlin leaders have declared defeat is inevitable. The military experts at West Point won't study Israel's wars because their outcomes are too impossible. But the anomalies don't stop on the battlefield. How did Hebrew become the only dead language in history to be revived after 2,000 years? Why would millions of people from around the world leave their homes for a desert wasteland to build new lives for themselves? How do these people manage to turn a land of more than 80% desert into one of the largest food and flower exporters in the world? Why have incredible achievements in science, medicine, and new technologies happen here in greater concentration than anywhere else? There are no logical answers. And, of course, from a natural point of view, that's right. There are no logical answers to the natural eye as to how Israel has come into being and survived impossible odds, except to believe that it's part of God's plan and that God is divinely intervening to make these things happen. I'd like to share with you just one miracle that occurred in Israel, and this is a personal testimony of a tank commander by the name of Avi Kahalani. Now, he's known by every school child in Israel as a great war hero. In fact, in the 1967 war, he was commanding a tank, and he was fighting against Egypt, and his tank was hit, and he was burned over 60% of his body. And he was taken to the hospital. He spent almost a year in the hospital, and he underwent 16 surgeries. And after the year was over, he wanted to go back to being a tank commander. He was a little too old, so he just kind of changed the dates on his paperwork to make himself younger. And he got back in. And in 1973, during the Yom Kippur War, he was sent to the Golan Heights. Golan Heights was amazingly strategic because the Egyptians and the Syrians decided to invade Israel on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of Israel's observances. And, of course, the reason they did that was because they felt the military would be participating in the observances of Yom Kippur, and so they would be more vulnerable to a surprise attack. And not only the surprise, it was a tremendous surprise to Israel, but the numbers of invaders was amazingly outnumbered Israel. In fact, on the Golan Heights alone, Israel had 150 tanks patrolling the border. The Syrians would bring in 1,400 tanks to invade Israel. And then on the Egyptian border, way at the other end of the country, Israel had 500 Israeli soldiers patrolling the border. The Egyptians would bring in 80,000 soldiers. So the numbers and the proportions are unbelievably lopsided on the Arab side. And it wasn't just Egypt and Syria who were attacking. They were the leaders, but they got jet fighters from who was it here? They were Russian jet fighters, but they were sent in by another Arab nation. I can't see it here. In the Golan Heights, 18,000 Iraqi soldiers were sent in. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait financed the war on the Arab side. Saudis sent in 3,000 men. Egypt had French-built Mirage fighter jets. And Libya bankrolled Egypt's military modernization to the tune of $1 billion. So they were building up and they were preparing for this invasion of Israel, fully expecting to destroy Israel. And again, by all military odds, they should have been destroyed. Well, as the battle progressed on the Golan Heights, hundreds of Syrian tanks were destroyed, and most of Israel's tanks were destroyed. After 3 days of fierce fighting, Kahalani was radioed by his commander, and the commander wanted to know how many tanks he had left. And he said, well, I have 41 left. And he inflated the number because he thought the Syrians might be listening. He had only 7 tanks left, to hundreds and hundreds of Syrian tanks. And the reason he did that was he knew there's no way we're going to stop the Syrians. We're just too outnumbered. He did that hoping that reinforcements would come, that at least with those 7 tanks, they could delay them long enough. Well, it dragged on and dragged on, but all of a sudden, the Syrian army stopped, they turned around, and the soldiers fled the other way, and he didn't understand what was happening. You know, we're only 7, and you guys have hundreds. And it was that reinforcements did come. But the miracle is how the reinforcements were provided. Let me quote from that film again. It says, Henry Kissinger had turned down a request by Golda Meir for arms to defend her country. Kissinger is reported to have said, let the Israelis bleed a little. But Golda Meir was desperate. Without help, Israel would not survive much longer. She then picked up the phone and called President Richard Nixon at 3 a.m. on his private line. When he took her call, she said, Mr. President, if you don't help us, the Jewish people will never survive. And he said something interesting, and I think this is where we see the hand of providence working. He said, I could almost hear my mother's voice. She would tell me stories and read to me from the Old Testament, the heroes of the Bible. And one afternoon she said to me, Richard, someday you're going to be in a position when you can help save the Jewish people. And when that day comes, you must do everything in your power. And he said, at that moment, I realized maybe for the first time in my presidency why I had become president of the United States. It was the largest airlift of armaments since World War II. The president kept his word. Everything Golda Meir asked for, she got. Every weapon, every vehicle, every piece of equipment, and all the ammunition to operate them. A virtual arsenal airlifted overnight to Israel's front lines. Many military experts credit that decision, that request, at that moment, as an essential element that saved Israel from destruction. The Yom Kippur War demonstrated the most incredible turnaround victory ever recorded in military history. And not only did the United States provide the military power, they also provided the intelligence. And there's one quote here, I won't take the time to read it. But they said, it's almost like when the prophet Elisha was ministering, the Syrians wondered, how does Israel always know where we're going to attack? And it turned out, well, the prophet Elisha would tell Israel they're going to attack here now and here. With the United States' intelligence, Israel knew where every enemy soldier was because the United States would fly these high-altitude reconnaissance planes over Israel, and they would give this intelligence to Israel. And so Israel, with its small forces, made these incredibly strategic attacks against the enemy when they could not have known where they were otherwise. And so the United States gave them the military power, equipment, and they also gave them the intelligence on how to fight. Well, this Kahalani was dubbed a war hero, and you can see why, because he had tremendous courage. But with all the courage of the soldiers, it could not have happened without the oversight of the Lord providing the miracle. And so he asked, well, let's itemize the miracles here. First of all, Golda Meir was a miracle. She was a woman who lived in Milwaukee. When Israel became a nation, she emigrated to Israel and somehow became prime minister. Her voice was a miracle that reminded Richard Nixon of his mother's voice. His mother was a miracle for reading him Old Testament Bible stories 40 years earlier that provided the impetus for him to believe in the Old Testament and to see Israel as a special nation. And, of course, the timing of putting this man who had been prepared 40 years earlier by the Lord with these stories in the position to do something about it, and then to have the ability, the resources of the mightiest nation in the world to come to Israel's help. These are just some of the little miracles that you don't see on the surface, but the Lord has to work them out for the big miracles to occur. Now, Richard Nixon has a bad reputation in this country for what he did later, but look at how the Lord used him to help Israel. And so it's miracle after miracle. There's tons of stories like this in how the big picture has to be developed through these small miracles that the Lord provided.
Thank you very much, Brother Todd. Very interesting. Next will be Brother George Tabak, and he has chosen Psalms 83, which will be to war with the Muslims. Brother George.
Well, brethren, in view of the ongoing conflict that exists between the Arab Muslims and Israel, it's natural for some to think and wonder, well, could this be the beginning of that final trouble of Jacob's trouble? And this is an indication that the enemy in this final battle is going to be the Arab Muslims. Well, I don't think that's the case. But rather, we believe that the current conflict with the Arab Muslims is the conflict that's prophesied in Psalm 83. It's a conflict, a war that precedes Jacob's trouble. Notice how the language of Psalm 83:1-4 is almost the exact words of the United Arab League after Israel became a nation in 1948. Slide. O God, do not remain quiet, for behold, your enemies make an uproar, and those who hate you have exalted themselves. They make shrewd plans against you, against your people, and conspire together against your treasured ones. They have said, come and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. And then it adds, with one mind they plot together. They form an alliance against you. Slide. Well, the following verses 6 to 8, go on to identify the 10 Arab nations that completely surrounded Israel. And incidentally, we'd like to mention that this coalition, this alliance mentioned here of these 10 nations never took place in biblical history. And thus, it's obvious it had to be prophetic. Well, brethren, this prophecy is being fulfilled before our very eyes. As Israel today, just like it was in this Psalm 83, is completely surrounded by Arab Muslim nations whose one greatest intent and goal is to drive Israel into the sea and destroy her forever. Well, Psalm 83, together with many other prophecies, go on to indicate that the Arabs will be defeated in this war, just like God previously helped defeat Israel's enemies before. Now, there are two basic reasons that we believe this war precedes Jacob's trouble, and that is, number one, when we examine the names of these 10 nations that surrounded Israel in Psalm 83, we find that every single name is a descendant of Shem. Every single one. Whereas if we look at the enemies in Ezekiel 38, where it gives us the names of the enemy in that final battle of Jacob's trouble, none, zero, are descendants of Shem. Five are direct descendants of Japheth, and three primarily refer to the area where the descendants of Ham settled. Well, thus it indicates that Psalm 83 and Jacob's trouble must be referring to two different events. The second reason is found in Ezekiel 38, verses 8 and 11, where referring to Jacob's trouble, we read of God speaking to Gog, the enemy from the north, saying, slide, "In future years you will invade a land that has recovered from war, whose people were gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had long been desolate. You will say, 'I will invade a land of unwalled villages. I will attack a peaceful and unsuspecting people, all of them living without walls, without gates and bars.'" Well, it's obvious that these verses are not describing the condition in Israel today. Today, Israel is preferably armed to the teeth, as it were, to protect themselves from the Arab Muslims who completely surround her, intent on her destruction. We believe the only way Ezekiel's strict description could take place prior to Jacob's trouble is for the Arab Muslims to have been defeated in a war prior to the final battle of Jacob's trouble. For it will only be after the Arabs are defeated could it be true that Israel will be a land recovered from war, a land of unwalled villages, a peaceful and unsuspecting people living without walls, bars, or gates. We realize that all these phrases indicate a peaceful setting without defensive armament. And the reason being is Israel's greatest enemy, the Arab Muslims, will have been defeated previously as described and prophesied in the War of Psalm 83.
Thank you, Brother George. And next will be Brother Jack Whitaker, and he has chosen the economy of Israel.
Brethren, most of what I'm going to say is kind of a repeat of things that you've heard, but that's a good confirmation, we hope. I chose a current look at Israel's economy is my topic because I believe it plays a part in fulfilling of God's plan that Israel will stand alone on the world stage. God indicated in his word many promises to restore Israel and bring her people back to the land. And we know one of those promises is found in Ezekiel 36, 6 to 11. The 36th chapter of Ezekiel deals with the restoration of Israel, with the message directed to those enemies that have been taunting her and claiming the land belongs to them. It addresses the fact that Israel's enemies have for a long time, beginning centuries ago, attacked from all directions and conquered the land time after time, making a mockery of the Lord's people. The Lord says that his jealous anger burns against these nations because they have shown utter contempt for the Lord by taking the land for a plunder. Verses 6 through 12 of the New American Standard Translation reads, "Therefore prophesy concerning the land of Israel, and say to the mountains and to the hills, to the ravines and to the valleys, thus says the Lord God, behold, I have spoken in my jealousy and in my wrath, because you have endured the insults of the nations. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, I have sworn that surely the nations which are around you will themselves endure their insults. But you, O mountains of Israel, you will put forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people Israel. For they will soon come. For behold, I am for you, and I will turn to you, and you will be cultivated and sown. I will multiply men on you, all the house of Israel, all of it. And the cities will be inhabited, and the waste places will be rebuilt. I will multiply on you man and beast, and they will increase and be fruitful. And I will cause you to be inhabited as you were formerly, and will treat you better than at the first. Thus you will know that I am the Lord. Well, we know that God greatly cares for Israel and her people, and he has directed the return of the Israelites from around the world to rebuild the cities, the ruined cities, and prosper even greater than in the past. Why? Because they are God's people, and all are to know that he is the Lord. Israel certainly has been blessed since 1878, and especially since she was declared an independent state in 1948. In a recent report by the International Monetary Fund, it was found that Israel's fiscal strategies helped it avoid the global crisis, and its economy is strong, while major economies around the world are struggling with recession, debt, and unemployment. As Israel grows stronger, its neighbors grow weaker, with political unrest and economic hardship. And I'd like to just read the rankings. This is from the Global Competitiveness Report by World Economic Forum. And as of 2012, Israel ranked 17th among 187 world nations on the UN's Human Development Index, which places it in the category of a very highly developed nation. Israel's economy also ranks 17th among the world's most economically developed nations, according to the World Competitiveness Yearbook Rankings. The Israeli economy was ranked as the world's most durable economy in the face of crisis. It was also ranked first in the rate of research and development center investments. The Bank of Israel was ranked first among central banks for efficient functioning. Israel was ranked first also in its supply of skilled manpower. Israeli companies, particularly in the high-tech area, have enjoyed considerable success raising money on Wall Street and other financial markets. And as of 2010, Israel ranked second among foreign countries in the number of companies listed on the U.S. stock exchange. We understand Israel is and will remain the most militarily powerful and economically dominant non-oil power in the Middle East. And we can see their disruption to the economies of Israel's neighbors by the people of those nations being tired of the suppression by their dictatorial national leadership. They rise up and they demand a change. Israel's participation in globalization in its many forms will continue to make it an object of envy and fear to its neighbors. Israel's economic growth will continue to distance it from its neighbors. As recently as 1980, the most widely recognized symbol of Israeli export was probably the Jaffa orange. Today's equivalent would be more like computer software and equipment. We know Israel was once a traditional economy. It was based on agriculture, on light industry and labor-intensive production. But now it has become a knowledge-based economy, as the brethren have mentioned. It has internationally competitive telecommunications, high-tech, agro-technology industries, and its per capita gross domestic product compares favorably with the European Union. Israel is prophesied to become an intolerable problem that world leaders think must be eliminated before there can be peace in the Middle East and in the world. God has as part of his plan that Israel will be a major obstacle to sin-flawed man-made peace. And we know that because we know that God's Son Jesus, the Prince of Peace, is really the only one that can bring true peace to the world. Zechariah 12:2-3 says, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces through all though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. Because Israel's economy is prospering, as directed by the Lord, we can see Israel's move towards self-dependence in the setting for her to stand alone against all nations.
Thank you, Brother Jack. I'd like to thank the panel for all of their thoughts. Now we have your time to participate in this program. So I'll call on one side and then the other side, and you could direct to which brother you'd like to ask a question. So you could feel free to ask a question on any point that the panel mentioned. Who'd like to be first to ask a question to the panel? Sister Joy, thank you.
They don't have a mic yet.
Could you take one of the mics, please? Yeah, it's coming. It's coming, Sister Joy. Thank you.
I have a question for each one of you, and each one of them is on a kindergarten level, because that's where my mind is on this subject. But I'll start with the first one. Now, that's Richard, I believe.
Yeah.
I was surprised, and maybe I read it wrong, that we always think about Persia as being the big element, and Iran was possibly a little town. I read that Iran was the big government, and Persia was just a part of it. So that's one thing. And then, going along with that historical thinking, I always thought, like Mark Twain wrote about going over to Israel and different ones of the 20th century, 19th century, that the Bedouin Arabs were not interested in advancement. But here we're talking about those people being very advanced, the way I would associate it with like the wise men of Persia. So those are my two questions, if you figured anything out of what I asked.
Okay, Brother Richard?
Well, Sister Joy asked some very good questions. We're referencing what's called the Golden Age of Islam, which was when they had, 1,000 years ago, the leading world economy. Number two was China. And they had the leading scientists. They had remeasured the earth accurately several times and developed new methods for measuring it. But your question was, how do we link Iran and Persia? I think we've all heard the term Aryan. And that term Aryan is directly linked to the name Iran. So, in fact, all of us who are of European descent are expatriate Persians. Okay? The furthest enclave was Ireland, which is Erie. Okay, link back to this word Aryan. These are the children of Japheth, and as Brother George pointed out very critically and importantly, when you look at those enemies early on, they are Semitic. Now, there's two on the list I have to disagree are not Semitic. The two are Philistines, which are a sea people from Hamitic descent, and the Tyrus, which is actually Tyre is of Japhethic descent. But the immediate neighbors around them are overwhelmingly Semitic, and they are the enemies at the beginning, and those near neighbors are not the enemies at the end. The Bedouin Arabs are not part of the Iranians, okay? They are not at all Iranians. The Arabs themselves in Iraq, which had a very advanced economy, set up what was called the House of Wisdom in the 800s. We have just been able to finish up the third volume of scripture studies reading on Read the Volumes. Let me put in a plug for that. And you had Alma Moon's forced entrance to the Great Pyramid. Alma Moon was an Arab in Iraq. He was an Iraqi who set up this university system that was successful for many, many centuries. And as a consequence, we have five times as much Greek learning that only survives in Arabic as compared to what survives in Greek, because they conserved all the knowledge that that the Christian mobs burned in the Library of Alexandria. So they were great conservators and innovators, and naturally, you know, we don't want to, you know, we don't have time to go into all of that, but the point is they are highly capable of reproducing 60-year-old technology or over 60-year-old technology for nuclear weapons. There's no question they can do it. They've got the brains. They've got the resources. They absolutely have the will.
Thank you. Sister Joy, you have another question? No, I thought...
I have 11 questions.
11 questions. Okay, we'll come right back to you. We'll see if anyone else... Okay, Sister Alice, we'll come back to you.
Where is Syria and Egypt in Psalm 83 or Ezekiel 38?
And who are you directing that to? Anyone? Okay. Anyone like to respond to that?
Egypt is where Amalek on the lower left was. And I am not sure now whether Syria is specifically mentioned. I don't believe so. It says, it's got... The going all the way around is the enemies of Psalm 83 are the tabernacles of Edom, the Ishmaelites, Moab, Hagarians, Gebel, Ammon, Amalek, the Philistines, Asher. They have come to help the children of Lot. So Assyria is not mentioned specifically in Psalm 83.
Yes, Brother Dan?
I need a mic.
Oh, yes. Okay. Pass the mic down.
I think Sister Alice's question was also in Ezekiel 38. I think what Brother George is mentioning, and I would agree with that, the war or the Psalms 83 is not part of the Gog and Magog invasion. I think that they are two separate wars, and I think, you know, I would agree with Brother George that the Psalms 83 comes first, and the Gog and Magog, and if you read in Ezekiel 38, in verse, when it talks about Gog and Magog, and it says that they... Where is it? I had it here and I lost it. But anyway, they come from the north. And one of the things, if you look towards due north of Turkey and you keep going up, you end up in southern Russia.
Right.
And all of southern Russia are Muslim, countries. They are not Christian countries. And that's one of the reasons why I personally believe that and it's a different set of Arabs or a different set of Muslims that come down. It's not the same. They're not the same ones that are in Psalms 83. Psalms 83 are defeated, and that's the ones that are right around the nation of Israel. But these come down from the north, and that's why I believe that they're coming down. To take a spoil, and as I said before, I believe that possibly the city of Jerusalem might be the spoil that they're coming down to take.
Thank you, Brother Dan. Okay, Brother Peter and Brother Richard.
Yeah, just quickly in Psalms 83, Edom is Moab and Ammon, which is modern-day Jordan. Amalek is the northern Negev, and that's really that area is occupied by Egypt. So there may be an indirect reference to Egypt there. The Philistines are the Palestinians on the Gaza Strip. Tyre and Gebel is Lebanon and possibly includes Syria. Here's these are my notes. Since they have been the dominant and controlling influence in Lebanon for many years, Asher, Assyria, or Iraq, the Ishmaelites and Hagarines, their identification is uncertain, but other Arab nations, so it could include some of the ones we're uncertain about. The Ishmaelites were nomads. They traveled and intermarried all over the Arab world. So Egypt, Syria, and Saudi Arabia are not clearly and directly mentioned. Egypt is Hamitic and may have been excluded. They're Hamitic and may have been excluded from the list because of that. But Syria and Saudi Arabia may be included in the difficult to identify Ishmaelites, Hagarines, and Amalek.
Thank you. Brother Richard?
When we look at Egypt, the Arabic name, the ancient name is Mizraim. And when you deal with that group of people, they survive today as a persecuted Christian minority called the Copts. And they've been in the news a few times lately, especially with this, you know, blatantly inflammatory movie that has been out, but let's not get into that. Most of Egypt are actually Arabs who have migrated and taken over and live there, but the traditional population is still there at about 15% of the current population, the Fellahin, the ones of Hamitic descent. So I think that's why they're not mentioned. But having said that, the Iranian bomb, because it's not, you know, it's going to happen. The Iranian bomb, the buzz in the intelligence community is that for the first time, you see the Saudis talking to Israel because neither one of them wants an Iranian bomb. And there's the split that's been alluded to between the Sunni and Shia. Iran is a Shiite Muslim country. All the rest of the enemies are Sunni Muslim countries. They really don't like each other. And none of them want to see Iran with a bomb. But Iran's got the bomb now.
Thank you. I'd also like to mention, I did read articles saying that the Arabs are supplying Israel with money to stop Iran. So it's a very interesting point that you're bringing out, that the most of the Arabs do not want Iran to have a bomb. Anyone else? Yes, Brother Joe on the right side. We'll go from side to side.
My question is directed at all the panel members, and and it's taking in the future state of Israel, which was part of the mandate of the panel, and we've heard primarily about the present and the historical and state of Israel, and I understand that the future state might be somewhat speculative in some areas, and so I'm, you know, maybe asking you to reach a little bit on this, but I'm asking anyone who's willing to offer an answer, maybe a little interpretive vision on how they foresee the state of Israel, the earthly situation yet to come after the prophetic elements are pretty much complete, and the wars have been fought and so forth, and the government yet to come is in place. And I'm wondering for a little vision on this to help us foresee into the future, if anyone has the proper eyeglass to see this. I'm wondering about the administrative, how the kingdom will be administered, the shape of the government, so to speak, on how certain things will be accomplished. Some things that came into my mind was, for example, how do we transition from an economy that we have right now based upon money into something that is not based on money? Does that just happen overnight? What about the infrastructure in the world scene now? All of your buildings and pipelines and electricity transmission and so forth. How does that get transitioned into the kingdom? And what about all the ecological damage that's been done in the world and things? I'm just wondering for thoughts on any of these things that might give us a little vision beyond what we've heard. Maybe some things can be applied, especially regards to natural resources. And if you do offer an answer, could you also specify what time frame you're talking about, whether you're talking about the mediatorial phase or in the ages to come?
Okay. Anyone wants to start? Jack, could we call on you first? Do you have any thoughts on how the economy is going to be transferred over, and how would the ancient worthies tie into this then? How will they take over the government and so forth? Then we can talk. I ask Brother Joe. Do you have any thoughts on that, Jack?
Very limited.
Well, whatever thoughts you have.
Yeah, well, I think it does depend on the time. You know, we could say that 100 years isn't a long time at all for some kind of a transition period to take place. And obviously, mankind has to eat and they have to drink. They have to have food and shelter and clothing. So those things are going to continue on. Now, in what capacity are they going to be received in the initial stages of setting up after the wars and so forth? And when the ancient worthies are on the scene, that's truly speculation. And I can just tell you that it will be a fair operating system, but I don't have any thoughts other than that.
Okay, all right. Brother Joe and then Brother Russ.
As Brother Joe said in his question, we really do sort of have to speculate a little bit here and use our imaginations. And I'll recommend to Joe that you read the Five Alive Again books that Brother Gene Burns wrote, because he actually goes into a lot of this in some detail as to what his imagination pictured the transition and the kingdom being like. But just to touch on a few of the specifics that you asked us to touch on. As far as the transition is concerned and how the government in Israel will become the government of the world, well, first of all, as has been mentioned, the ancient worthies will be delivering Israel out of a time of great distress. So I think the nearest term thing we look for is this time of great distress upon the nation of Israel. She's in great trouble militarily, politically, socially. So she turns to God. God raises the ancient worthies. They obviously manifest their superior abilities so that all the world can see this. I mean, they're on the 6 o'clock news. CNN is doing 24/7 coverage of these people that are turning things around in Israel, delivering them out of this trouble that all of the world is also watching on CNN. So I think that near term is how the transition goes from now to the kingdom initially being set up. After that, in the peaceable kingdom of righteousness, and again, that's long-term, but I can't define long-term, how many years in the future that is. As the panel has touched on, Israel has always been in the forefront of technological advancements. One of the speculations or the imaginations that Brother Gene Burns included in his Alive Again books was that in the kingdom, the energy potential of antimatter would be harnessed to power homes and factories and everything. Cleanly and effectively and efficiently. And so maybe some technological breakthrough along that line or something else is the way that the mechanics of the kingdom and the restoration of the earth to its
Edenic-like conditions will be brought about. And then the last piece of it that he also included, which I like, is that the food supply in the kingdom will be much purer and better than it is now, that there will be breakthroughs in farming, plant life, harvesting. I think he even speculates that some seeds that existed in the Garden of Eden were miraculously preserved and now are still hidden somewhere on the earth and will be brought out in the kingdom to help mankind grow what they need to eat to regain that perfection of their natural being. Then the last piece, I think you mentioned something like, what about pollution? And let's say there is some nuclear war that breaks out on a limited scale that pollutes a large section of the country or the world. And I remember hearing on the news not too long ago that in Florida they have actually found some plants in the swamps that can filter out all of the pollution, even the heavy metals, the residues of nuclear waste, and so on. And so I think there are many secret hidden things in nature today that mankind will discover by God's revelation and harness to bring about what we imagine as being that perfect kingdom of peace.
Thank you. Brother Russ?
I'll just add a little bit to what Brother Joe said, and I agree with it entirely. I think there'll be a couple overriding principles here. The recognition of the ancient worthies, the recognition of the new order that's going on will be paramount in all the peoples of the world. And the sooner and more quickly they come into alignment with that, the greater will be blessings flow to them and their immediate community, let's say, because then we know the nations are going to disappear. And so that'll become the driving principle that brings mankind up to, you know, gets them on the path of walking up the highway of holiness. It will be the recognition that if we go along with this new arrangement, problems disappear and blessings come. I'm sure that will be that. And just one more item I thought was part of your question. We spent some time talking with Brother Ed about this, Brother Ed Grabner, last week when we entertained him, was how will the ancient worthies be recognized as the authoritarian figures? And Brother Joe had a good point that they'll be covered over the media, but I think one of the things they'll be able to bring to the world is pointing to areas of Israel to say, this is what happened here, dig here, or inspect this area here. This is when we were here, this is what happened here. And those artifacts that have not been discovered, that will be discovered, and exactly where the ancient worthies will tell them, will identify them as people, the only people that could have known, that could be alive at that time, that could have known where those things happened. And obviously once the resurrection begins, that process won't be necessary anymore, but the point where the ancient worthies return and need to be authenticated, that they really are Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, etc., they will have knowledge that only they could possess, and that will authenticate them to the world.
Okay, thank you. George is next. Brother George?
Yeah, in regards to the transition, Brother Russell, in three different places, three different reprint articles, brings out a sequence more or less like this. Of course, the first thing that has to happen is everyone who has received the benefit of the merit for justification must go into death. After everyone has, that is the church, great company, second death class, and all go beyond, then the blood will be applied on behalf of Adam. And then the next step will be the inauguration of the new covenant. But what's a little bit unique in these three articles is Brother Russell says that the new covenant will then be made with the mediator acting on behalf of Israel. And the reason why he brings that out in these three things is that the new covenant must be in effect before the ancient worthies can be raised, that they have to be under the new covenant. And so from that standpoint, Our Lord as mediator acts on Israel's behalf and saying, in essence, Father, I guarantee that all who will become Israel, Israel will obey these, will come under the terms of this covenant, and all of mankind who will become Israelites indeed will become under this covenant, and those that refuse, I will remove. So I like that aspect that the covenant is made. And therefore, the ancient worthies, when they're raised, they're immediately under the new covenant arrangement. And of course, they will put forth the knowledge of God's plans and purposes. And then all the holy remnant of Israel, as they make their consecration, will be under the terms of it. And whoever will, of the rest of Israel, of all mankind who will make a consecration, will come under the terms of this covenant that will already have been made in effect after the blood is first applied.
Okay. Brother Tom, and then I'm going to add a few thoughts of my own. Brother Tom.
Oh, Jesus. Well, when Joe was asking about that interim period between Armageddon and the setting up of the kingdom, I thought about Joseph and how he prepared for the 7 years of plenty. He accumulated food and everything for the 7 years of famine. And I think when we think of Armageddon, we think of mass worldwide destruction. But I think it will be much more strategic than that, that there's no reason to destroy every farm, every farm implement. And so I think farming will still be possible during Armageddon, and that will prepare food enough for mankind in that interim period where things aren't quite organized. And also we know that the United States government has vast resources of oil and food stored up just for certain emergencies. And I don't think we're the only country that does that. So it could be that those are the stores that the Lord will preserve in order to get mankind through this interim period. I like the analogy with Joseph in preparation for that, though.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Tom. I'd like to add a few thoughts here. In 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter, Jehoshaphat is king, and he's surrounded by all of the nations around him. And I think what George was talking about, that I believe this is my own thought, that the ancient worthies will be on the scene before the final attack on Israel. And in 2 Chronicles, the 20th chapter, Jehoshaphat prays to the Lord and says, "Our eyes are fixed on you, and we claim the promise that you promised this land to us." And God said, "This will be my battle," and Israel did not have to fight. They were delivered. And in Zechariah 12:10, it says, "The nation of Israel will recognize Jesus, whom they have pierced." So the ancient worthies will get recognition that they are the leaders of Israel. And as was brought out, they'll go on television and say that I'm Abraham or Moses. And they'll be able to prove that they are actually Abraham and Moses, and the ancient worthies will take over the government, and it'll start to prosper. And as we all the things that were brought out by the panel and what Brother Russ was bringing about, all the inventions that are yet to come, Israel will be the leading nation, and they'll be the most prosperous nation. And whoever comes under that particular arrangement, in Zechariah, it says that the Lord will prosper all of the people who come to Israel, and then it will be fulfilled that 10 people will try to get the skirt or the hand of the Jew because they'll recognize that God is with them. Any short comment by any of the panel members, and then we'll have to close. Any comment from anyone? Yes, Brother Dan.
You know, one of the things, if you stop to think about, when you go back to our Lord Jesus when he was on the scene, he was perfect, and he stood out. And it says, "No, never spake a man like this man did." I mean, you know, this stood him out. When you think about the ancient worthies being resurrected, they're also going to be resurrected perfect human beings, and from that aspect, they will have the intellect and the knowledge to convince
the nation of Israel at that point in time and be able to gainsay any of the, you know, the gainsayers that are against them. And also, when you continue reading in Zechariah, the 14th chapter, after the miraculous Gog and Magog invasion, it says that if anybody doesn't come up,
yes, right.
If anybody doesn't come up, there will be no rain. Then it says there will be plagues that will come upon them, right. You know, those that do not come up. And so, you know, God is going to be, you know, not, if you want to call it, not recognizable. These are things that man has no control over. Man doesn't have any control over the weather, but God does.
Yes. And it also mentions in Ezekiel 38 that when Israel will be delivered, God will be sanctified among all the nations. So evidently this will be a worldwide knowledgeable fact that Israel has been delivered and that God is with Israel. And I'm amazed that the scriptures bring out the point that the first thing that the world will recognize is that Israel was being punished for that double period of disfavor. And when they recognize that God is with Israel, they'll recognize that the time of disfavor is over. So that would be the setting up of the kingdom. What we're going to do is let's all rise, and we're going to sing the doxology. And then we'll ask Brother Russ Martin to lead us in prayer. And before everyone goes into the lunchroom, the deacons want a little bit of time to take these tables, and they have to be set up in the lunchroom. So just pause for a little while for the deacons to take these tables into the lunchroom. And I'd like to thank the panel for their participation, and I'd like to admonish everyone to watch anything on the computer, in the newspaper, on the TV about Israel, because the prophecies have to be fulfilled through Israel.